Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we are looking back to an interview we did with Dr. Ishmael Traore on an event called Where Are All the Black People?, which was an event series looking at the lack of diversity in academia. Here is that interview.
So first, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the series, Where Are All the Black People?
Yeah, so my name is Ishmael Traore. My gender pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm here on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people in South Vancouver, BC. The series Where Are All the Black People stems from two things. One, the underrepresentation of Blackness at UBC and, as the book Equity Myth shows, across the universities in Canada, especially in leadership. And it also is informed in part by the reckoning on racism that was elevated last year following the murder of George Floyd, and also incidents of racism at UBC that has happened 2-3 years now that have caught the public imagination and concerns of a lot of people. And it also stems from just like the continuing structural forms of racism that we see in universities, and UBC is definitely not immune to that. And at times, you know, racism takes the form not so much of what people are doing, but what people are not doing. In other words, resistance to anti-racism recommendations does keep racialized structures and disparities in place. And so this series is informed by these, and in particular is interested in elevating the voices of faculty members and other individuals who are especially in disciplines that have not, that do not have like a long historical presence to engaging on issues of anti-racism. And, you know, for example, the social sciences, especially sociology, political science, the discipline of education and related fields, there is a lot of critical thinking around anti-racism and law as well that stems from these fields. But there are many other disciplines in the university where there are few Black folks, or sometimes none, depending on the university you're looking at. And there is also this need to make sure that we understand what are the unique struggles, for example, of Black people in STEM, especially Black women in STEM. What about the struggles of Black people who are in business? And so you will see that the discipline focus on this series, in this series, is specifically inviting faculty members who are in fields that are exceptionally, that have an exceptional underrepresentation of Black people.
The series, as you just mentioned, does focus on disciplines and faculty members. Can you speak a bit to the impact that underrepresentation has in academia has on students, and Black students in particular?
Yeah, there are multiple, psychological and social, right? So on the social side, we see a lot of racial disparities when it comes to educational outcomes. And, you know, depending on, you know, depending on if you want to start off at the secondary all the way to the post-secondary, but we see disparities, for example, in who is more likely to experience punitive measures from staff, for example, expulsions or suspensions or detentions that especially happen in secondary schools. We find that Black students and Indigenous students are disproportionately more likely to be to face these types of punitive interventions. And there's also a lot of emotional scars that stem from being in an environment, in an educational environment, where the way that people speak about you, interact with you, or depending on the discipline, speak about your part of the country, your part of, you know, either where you were born or where your descendants are from, your history, that is through a Eurocentric lens. And the Eurocentric lens inherent in that is this kind of like negative appraisal of or undermining of the histories of other people from other parts of the world, especially if they're Black. And so there is a lot of, there's a lot of emotional and psychological scars and identity crises that could occur for a lot of Black students when they find themselves in spaces where they're, the way that they look and the experiences as a result of that, well, more specifically as a result of racism, is not acknowledged. There are many other types of disparities that we see amongst Black students and concerns that they often voice, such as resources in order for them to, well, if it's not them directly, for other people to develop programs that are specific to who they are in terms of quote unquote Black culture, that speak more to their interests. And why I say this is important is because of this concept of inclusion. There's often a lot of emphasis on diversity. And so we see quite some, you know, there are quite a few Black students, at least at UBC, there's some Black students at the undergrad level, but then that starts to decrease when you go to grad school and starts to decrease when you're looking at faculty and leadership. And while diversity is very important and is in fact the bedrock of this conversation, at least one of them, inclusion is another important dimension. And inclusion is about, once somebody is in a university, once a Black student is in a university, do they feel welcomed? Do they feel represented? Do they feel at home? Or do they feel that they still have to walk on eggshells? And so we do see a lot of Black students at UBC as well, who are asking for better infrastructure for them, right? Better spaces for them, and programs, a program like a Black Canadian or a Afrocentric program that allows people to get a not only a minor but also a major, to be able to major in African studies or Black studies, and also to have that at for that to be an expertise that one develops in a master's or a PhD programs, are also very important for students. But we, you know, those are struggles that students currently at UBC are, you know, have undertaken for several years now, to see the development of a Black studies or an African studies program that is beyond a minor undergraduate program.
I do want to speak a bit about the events, the upcoming events, but you mentioned at the top of the interview that racism happens with what people do, but also what they don't do. How does academia create barriers, and what actions should academic institutions be taking to dismantle this or become anti-racist?
There are many things that institutions can do. But starting off, I think it's important to acknowledge that addressing racism also requires addressing other forms of isms. Because, for example, Black women cannot separate their Blackness from their womanhood, or Black folks who are part of the LGBTQ communities cannot separate their sexual orientation from their racial identity. And so there needs to be an intersectional approach in how institutions such as universities go about wanting to dismantle racism and usher forth equity. So one of my suggestions would be that whatever recommendations are developed, that they fall into the following categories, and all the categories have to be full of recommendations. Obviously, there are some recommendations related to diversity, which is all about increasing representation of an equity-seeking or an equity-deserving group, such as racialized folks, such as Black folks. Another one is we need a variety of actions related to recognition, which is all about inclusion, and taking a more critical approach to inclusion that is not so much about, that doesn't lead to assimilation, right? Because inclusion can lead to that. If the assumption is that we will include you in this space, but the sacrifice you have to make is to become colorblind, is to leave your race, quote unquote, at the door, is to not speak about issues related to racism. That is not an inclusive space. A space that requires that you be less of yourself is not an inclusive space. And so inclusion requires that there is actually an acknowledgement that what people are being included to already have a set of culture, practices, norms, procedures, and policies, and a history that is informed by white supremacy, racism, or at the very least by Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Celtic Eurocentrism, and that is informed by male supremacy, heterosexual supremacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So inclusion requires that the spaces that people are, quote unquote, being invited into, or spaces where people are going into, that they themselves be reconfigured based on new norms that are more in alignment with human rights, more in alignment with equity and inclusion, and so on and so forth. Now, another category, in addition to making sure there are recommendations for diversity and inclusion, is making sure that there are also recommendations for equity. And here I'm specifically speaking to identifying barriers that Black students, staff, and faculty disproportionately face, removing those barriers, and also developing initiatives, programs, policies, practices, procedures that are targeted for the well-being, the inclusion, and the increased representation of Black people. So equity, in a nutshell, refers to targeted interventions in order for access to be gained by certain groups. The other category that I would recommend that people develop recommendations around is a category of justice. And what does, in this modality, justice implies that a wrong was done, and therefore there has to be a reparation has to be made. And justice can take many forms, but what we're seeing right now is that the definition, for example, of racism in the Human Rights Code, which universities also adopt, tends to be mainly about individual cases of, for the most part, overt or at the very least identifiable racism. And in other words, the bar for what racism looks like within a lot of universities who use a human rights approach to addressing racial discrimination ignores the more subtle but nonetheless systemic and influential and detrimental forms of racism. And so this concept of justice has to increase beyond the present liberal legal framework that tends to be, for the most part, individualized. And finally, there needs to be a lot of recommendations related to accountability, right? Accountability is a great indicator to see to the extent that an institution is prioritizing or giving importance to a particular action that it's attempting to develop or has developed. And so universities need to develop robust forms of accountability that are both hard and soft, and also provide incentives for anti-racism to be picked up by different faculties and units and for it to be normalized. Now, in terms of actual recommendations, there are so many, but I would recommend that universities across Canada look at the Scarborough National Charter on Anti-Black Racism and Black Inclusion in Canadian Higher Education. This charter is informed or stems from the National Dialogues and Action for Inclusive Higher Education Communities that took place, I believe, in October last year, where you had close to 60 different institutions across Canada and thousands of individuals attend this two-day forum. And this charter is intending to set some very practical aspirations, goals, and actions that universities across Canada can take in order to address anti-Black racism and develop equity. So those will be some recommendations from the top of my head. There are some other specific ones that I could really get into, but at the end of the day, it has to fall into those categories that I mentioned. One very basic one, for example, is disaggregated data. Disaggregated and intersectional data has to be collected. So we know the demography of people in different ranks, so to speak, of the university. And making sure that the purpose or the framework for data collection, usage, reporting is informed by human rights and other equity principles. It's very important as well to create, an example would be to develop or add, if you will, equity skills as requirements in key job descriptions, key job responsibilities. So, one way to really make sure that anti-racism is part of all aspects of an institution or all aspects of a university, is to require, for example, that middle management and higher management slash leadership as well, you know, that people in these positions come with a robust EDI background with a particular focus on issues of race, since that is what we're talking about here. I would also suggest regular audits of faculties, of units, of departments, of portfolios, equity units, equity audits that can get to identifying what are existing disparities, what type of progression has been made on anti-racism or equity as a result of a plan that has been developed, and that can come up with targeted recommendations specific to a particular unit. Related to an equity audit is also a pay audit. And so in some universities have done pay gap analysis in the context of gender, but I'm not aware of any universities that have done a race gap, race income gap analysis or audit. And that is very, very important to do. You know, last but not least, I think it's also important to make sure that the work of anti-racism is not siloed to just one office, which often in universities tends to be an equity and inclusion and or a human rights office, but that this work happens across all portfolios, all units. The silos that universities and other organizations tend to have mean that certain institutional changes that are required bump up against the different silos. And so it's important that in the development and the implementation of anti-racism recommendations and the process of organizational anti-racism, that a cross-portfolio approach takes place. So those will be some of, you know, key recommendations and suggestions that come to me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So to kind of turn back to the event, so there's already been a few in the series, including Black underrepresentation in medicine, Black women in STEM, and others. Can you tell us a bit about the recent events and what some of the key takeaways were? I know they were pretty different topics, but what were some of the key takeaways?
Right. So yes, we've had I believe 4 events so far. One on underrepresentation in leadership administration, another one on Black women in STEM, another one on underrepresentation in medicine and community health, and then one on underrepresentation in business. All amazing speakers with amazing stories, moving stories, and very practical and great suggestions for what universities and other institutions can do. It's very hard to summarize what my colleagues have shared on these panels, but I think ultimately it is 2 things. If not now, when? And that's a rhetorical question. In other words, if institutions are not going to do meaningful anti-racism and transformative anti-racism now, then when is the right time? And obviously there's never a right time besides right now. And also the mantra which many equity deserving groups use, which is nothing about us without us, right? And so there has to be great engagement, wide engagement that universities do as they develop plans, making sure that students, staff, and faculty can share their thoughts on what these recommendations are about, and also take the lead on some of these recommendations or on some of these processes if the capacity is there for them to do. I think that another key suggestion as well is that there is no lack of Black excellence in Canada. But what we see is a pipeline problem, so to speak. And also what we see is a revolving door problem in the sense that the pipeline for targeted hiring of Black people has not been sufficiently well developed, and all pipelines related to hiring are developed. And this one hasn't really sufficiently been developed. There's a lot of great excellence, but unfortunately, we need more universities to do a better job at reaching out to potential candidates, and also what is necessary in order for them to feel welcomed, appreciated once they are hired, so that we don't succumb to the revolving door. Another one is the glass ceiling, which is often used in a gender context and also applies to race, where we want to make sure that faculty and also staff are in a university where they feel that they can progress into leadership positions if that is something that they would like to do. And we see the lack of representation in leadership, and that is a reflection of long-term and compounding forms of racial inequities, whether intended or not intended. So those are some of the key takeaways in any attempt to summarize this, which is really hard because all these panelists have amazing suggestions. And so the panel discussions we've held are available online for people to watch. And they also have ASL interpretation. So people are more than welcome to just type "Where are all the Black people UBC" on Google, and they'll find our events page.
Excellent. And for the events upcoming, I know there's quite a few as well. So can you tell us a bit about the upcoming events, or maybe just any that you're personally particularly looking forward to?
Right. I'm looking forward to all of the remaining events. The panelists and this event was really well curated by my colleagues and I, who are all named on our website. So the upcoming three events, there's one that is happening on Thursday, which is on Black underrepresentation in art history. And here there will be a lot of focus on the experiences of both a faculty member, but also a PhD candidate in art history. And I think this is the only event where we have a PhD candidate that can also talk to that student experience of Black underrepresentation in art history. The one after that on June 23rd is on Black women in the academy. And as most of the listeners will be aware of, that having, based on intersecting identities, there are different either sometimes types, but more often it's about degrees of barriers and racialized harms that people experience, or harms or systemic harms that people experience. So Black Women in the Academy is on June 23rd. We have some amazing speakers that are going to be present for that. And then we're finally going to wrap up with an event on July 5th, which is Black Futures. And that's on moving into the future. What does that look like? How could we reimagine Black anti-racism within a university context? What are some trends for us to be mindful of? What are some opportunities that are opening? So I encourage the listeners to come to these three events and watch the other events that we've had on our website.
Absolutely. And we'll be sure to link that on our website. But for those who do want to attend the events online or learn more about the series, where can they go?
Yeah, they can go to events.ubc.ca/where-are-all-the-black-people, or they can just type "Where are all the Black people UBC" on Google, and surely they will find this event. They can also go to antiracism.ubc.ca and click events, and they will see the series posted there, and they can have access to it through antiracism.ubc.ca. It may help to know at UBC, there are currently two strategic plans that have been developed that are all about equity and inclusion and also decolonization. So for any of your listeners that are curious and interested in what UBC is doing to advance the human rights of Indigenous people, I encourage them to find the ISP, which stands for the Indigenous Strategic Plan, and read through that. They have really done a comprehensive assessment and identified key areas and actions, and also a structure for operating the plan at UBC that could be a great inspiration to other organizations, especially post-secondary educations out there. For that, all you have to do is just go to indigenous.ubc.ca and then click the Indigenous Engagement menu, and then click the Indigenous Strategic Plan. There is also the Inclusion Action Plan, the IAP, that is currently under a process of operation at UBC. And that plan also identifies, about 5 areas and I believe 32 goals, 5 goals and 32 actions that the university can take in order to advance equity and inclusion in the university. And also your listeners will probably be interested to know that we have an anti-racism task force at UBC that are doing amazing, very comprehensive work when it comes to anti-racism transformation for the in the university, coming up with a lot of recommendations, both the what and the how. And I encourage your listeners to, keep their eyes on antiracism.ubc.ca because updates about the task force and the work that they're doing will be mentioned there. So those are some key plans that currently are in either already exist or are close to existing at UBC. And wanting to emphasize here that it's very important for there to be a collaborative and alignment between a collaboration and an alignment between the human rights of Indigenous people and also equity and inclusion efforts. It is not uncommon that at times that the human rights of Indigenous peoples tends to be considered a element of EDI, of equity, diversity, inclusion writ large, but that is not the approach being taken at UBC for very important reasons. And so it's one recommendation to organizations is that they make sure that a level of distinction exists between the concerns and recommendations of and by Indigenous people and those of other equity-seeking group members. And even in the equity-seeking group umbrella, there has to be targeted initiatives for specific equity-seeking groups. And some sort of alignment as well at times is very important while acknowledging the distinction. So that's my last parting words.
Perfect. Thank you for adding that. I'm sure our listeners will find a lot of inspiration and as well as for our own initiatives here. So thank you.
Thanks, Anna.
Been so you done all. Oh, how long would
had the chance to speak with the founder of Hizontic. Hizontic is a safe space for queer and BIPOC individuals to express themselves through experimental fashion, performance, and community. Here to chat more about it is founder Dina.
Hi, my name is Dina. I'm the founder and creative director of Hizontic. I'm also a multidisciplinary artist, and my work centers around cultural and societal intersectionalities. And my passion lies within the realm of visual arts with underlying social commentary. So I really focus on making safe communal spaces for marginalized identities and really encourage taking up that space.
Awesome. So can you tell us, as you mentioned, you're a founder. So can you tell us a little bit about how this project began? Maybe before in its current form.
Yeah, also I just want to say, like Hizontic for me, I pronounce it Hizontic. I guess I'll just start with the name. Let's start with that. So when I was brainstorming for the store's name, I stumbled upon Hizontic, and I knew that it was the one instantly, but then I was hesitant because of the letter Kha. It just means, the word itself means your closet in Arabic. And my first thought was, how would non-Arabic speaking individuals pronounce it? And then I recognized that in that thought, I was compromising on my identity and culture, and I decided that it didn't matter. Everything in the past, everything I did was about being neutral and about just compromising on my identity to make everyone else comfortable. But everyone else, as in basically like non-Arabs, I always felt like Arabs were so loud and took up so much space. So I just like since moving to Canada, I've been like making myself smaller and smaller and smaller. So yeah, I just decided that it didn't matter. And that's the whole point. So even with the word Hizontic, I'm celebrating that letter Kha. And it just means that for those who are not familiar with this letter, they can just say however sounds right or however sounds natural. And there's really no wrong to say it, no wrong way to say it. But for me, it's Hizontic. Hizontic is a space for queer and BIPOC individuals to express themselves through experimental fashion, performance, and community. Hizontic is an ethical and inclusive fashion, culture, and identity-centered platform and store. And this will manifest in selling slow fashion or secondhand items. It will also manifest in events and pop-ups that center local artists and other BIPOC creatives in Montreal, and just overall represent and celebrate queer and BIPOC expression and individuality.
Awesome. I love that you mentioned that about the name. That's such a, that's great that you didn't compromise. So can you tell us a bit about how, so as you mentioned, it's a safe space for queer and BIPOC individuals. Can you tell us more about what this means for the initiative and why it was important to center?
Yeah, of course. So bi and four spaces are so important because they highlight and validate the lived experience of marginalized communities. And these spaces are also anti-colonial in their essence. It's just so important to highlight this and to provide spaces that are dedicated to the representation, celebration, and safety of queer BIPOC individuals. So connecting with fellow BIPOCs and just building a community where there's a common understanding and you don't even have to explain yourself or make your identity small and compromise on who you are just because you're surrounded with folks who relate to your experience. And that's just been really life-saving for me. Community and spaces that are specifically dedicated to queer BIPOCs have healing powers. And it just overall encourages taking up space and making that space for yourself that otherwise you wouldn't have been offered because of oppressive socio-political realities. So Hizontic really just says that you don't have to choose between appropriating or surrendering your non-white identity. And it just says that you can, I guess, redefine your identity in a way that serves yourself to celebrate rituals and traditions. And yeah.
So you mentioned it, there's a focus on kind of slow fashion, fashion events. What's your, an experimental fashion. So what's your personal connection
with experimental fashion and performance, and how did your experience inform this project?
Okay, so this might get a little bit deep, but so having a degree in women's studies and business studies is really what paved the way for this project to come to life. Business studies, I would say, taught me technical skills, traditional modes of business, and entrepreneurship, whereas women's studies sharpened my skills in critical thought and just equipped me with an intersectional understanding of the world. Experimental fashion for me has to do with how you approach a traditional concept of a clothing store and how you adapt it to your needs. So that being like your identity needs, your financial needs. For me, it's just first and foremost an accessible way to be an entrepreneur. So Chizantic is a raw project. It's a transparent space, but mostly a space that challenges colonial and patriarchal and capitalist notions. This means that it doesn't really matter what the structure is. It's flowy, it's a play it by ear type of project. And what I mean by that is that the idea of following a strict business plan and a strict structure when it comes to stores is very capitalist. So Chizantic shies away from that. It also alleviates some of the societal pressures of conforming to all these rules and business models and colonial ways of living. And it just encourages alternative ways of productivity and a more accessible way of entrepreneurship. It's experimental in every sense of the word. So it really centers creative processes that don't put too much pressure on structure, but more importantly, it's exciting and forgiving, fun and ever-changing. Also, I choose to use the word performance because I find that it highlights how in today's online world, everything is a performance. So it's a good and bad thing in a way. I feel like it takes away some of the pressure of presenting yourself and being vulnerable. It sort of just like represents a shield. We're constantly performing for others, but it doesn't have to be a bad thing. In this context, it just means that you can choose to present yourself exactly as you wish to be perceived. And there's so much power in that. And it allows space for drama, theatricals, and just like anything outside of the norm. And this was important for me to also center because of how rigid the Arab community can be and the lack of representation of Arabs in these spaces. So Arab community is very heavy on reputation and honoring reputation. So just having this kind of representation out there and like being in public and just as that you can let loose. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks, it's all just performance anyways. But yeah, it says you can be any version of yourself that you want to be and feel comfortable presenting that and being perceived as such without the pressure of defining it. It just says like it's not that deep. And just entrepreneurship in general for me, it took me such a long time to like start any business endeavors just because it just feels very intimidating and just it's not accessible to everyone, but it also doesn't have to be that bounded and that just that deep. It's just you it just also encourages others to just do it. Like just do it, go with the flow. Don't set too many expectations for yourself because whatever comes out of it will come out. And it's just a matter of being consistent and believing in yourself.
A little earlier, you mentioned the importance of community in building this. So can you tell us a little bit about what the reception has been so far or the impact that it's had or that you hope for it to have?
Yeah. Before Chizantic was Chizantic, it was DDC, which was just an online thrift store. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is because without DDC, Chizantic would have never come to light because DDC really taught me the meaning of community and how supportive and necessary community is. DDC was a super DIY in my closet, winging it type of situation, but it paid the bills and it paid the bills because of the community who believed in me, trusted me and just supported me. So so far with Khizantik, I only just rebranded it and launched it, and I'm just really excited for what's to come. Like, it's just everything is falling into place, and it just makes so much sense. It's been received with so much love, support, and enthusiasm. And although the DDC community was very small and humble, every single item I would put out would sell within seconds. And again, all of this just happened because of the community. Like, it was a following of around 500 people, but every single person there really contributed to it. And even with the pop-ups and the collaborations, like, it just turned into a communal hub of trading and selling and buying clothes. So it's what had made DDC, but also community is what is what I'm trying to say is that community is what makes Khizantik what it's going to be. And yeah, I'm really thankful for that. And also the way DDC had started was people coming up to me and asking me if I could sell on their behalf or if they could use my platform. So it was just like word of mouth and connections and connecting with people and everyone just like selling together and showing up for each other. So yeah, community has definitely been life-changing for me.
I love to hear it. That's so great. You mentioned also earlier fashion, but also events coming up. So what are your hopes for the future? What kind of events do you plan on holding? All those things.
Yeah, I'm really trying to, I just want to connect with other creatives in Montreal and highlight other artists, queer and BIPOC individuals. And for events, it would really just be like BIPOC markets and DJs and artists and just like coming together and highlighting each other. I'm working towards expanding the Khizantik team and towards having a self-sustaining clothing store that just gives back to the community. I'm also hoping to launch a magazine in 2022 that highlights Arab, queer, and BIPOC art. So merging the two would also be in the books. I'm just super excited for the future of Khizantik, and I'm really looking forward to collaborating with other fellow queer BIPOC creatives. And also cannot wait to launch the website. That's coming soon.
Oh, that's exciting. Cool. So speaking of the website to be launched, but where in the meantime, where can people learn more or find you online?
So for now, Khizantik is operating on Instagram, which is its main platform. So it's at Khizantik, spelled K-H-E-Z-A-N-T-I-K. You can also keep an eye out on the brand on what's coming next there, but the website will be launching soon. We also just launched the Khizantik TikTok for some fun video content. So it's the same handle as K-H-E-Z-A-N-T-I-K. Otherwise, you can find me and follow up on my work on Instagram at Dina Shihabi. So D-I-N-A-S-H-I-H-A-B-I. And for other content that's relevant on TikTok, at the Dina Shihabi. So T-H-E-D-I-N-A-S-H-I-H-A-B-I.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
That was our interview with Dina, the founder of Khizantik, a safe space for queer BIPOC individuals to express themselves through experimental fashion, performance, and community.
my soul. I will come to your river. Wash my soul again. Carry away my dead leaves. Let me baptize my soul with the help of your waters. Sink my pains and complaints. Let the river take them. River. Wash my soul.
I will come to your river.
Wash my soul.
I will come to your river.
Wash my soul again. Carry away my old leaves. Let me baptize my soul with the help of your waters. Sink my pains and complaints. Let the river take them. River, drown.
Coast and Guadeloupe with Demi Arosena, Donald Dogbo, Etopium. Broadcast live on the New Def.
Good evening, Montreal. You're listening to Underground Sounds on CKUT. I'm your host, Nick Schofield, and this is the Monday, May 25th, 2020 episode, broadcasting at 90.3 FM and online at ckut.ca. I'm on the airwaves every Monday,